This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Jessica Maria Tuccelli. She's the author of Glow, a novel, and this is her first book. I want to say this is an amazingly wonderful book, so I think pretty amazing for a first novel. How are you, Jessica?
I'm good. Thank you, David. How are you?
I'm great. I love this book. I have a predisposition. I do like historical novels, I'm very fond of North Carolina and, Western Georgia, Western South Carolina as a place, which is, your book takes place in Western Georgia.
Eastern.
I thought it was Western.
Northeastern Georgia, although I do have a scene that goes all the way out to Western Georgia. It takes place in the mountains in Northeastern Georgia.
Right. Well, that's what threw me off. So in my mind, I placed these people in Northwestern Georgia, which is terrible. So
yeah.
I'm glad that you pointed that out to me. It's a big, big difference.
No problem.
And it's a complicated novel, and I think that there were places where, I wasn't quite sure where I was, so that's obviously an effect on me. But maybe you could talk a little bit about, the story. I think, it opens with a young girl in 1941 who is in Washington, D.C., but you switch pretty quickly, I think, to Georgia. And that's sort of the launching point for the story going backward in time.
Yeah.
And then you switch voices throughout. But maybe you want, and we don't, I don't really want to give away the story. I think it's really important in a novel that, we assume most of the people listening to this podcast have not read the book. So, maybe just talk in general terms about what got you to the point of writing about people who's really you have no personal connection to?
That's a good question. I ask myself that often. I feel like it's the book or the roots of the book is, I think of it as a tree, because there's no one specific spark that got me on this particular story. I had written the first chapter here in New York, which is where I live, and I had no setting. I had a girl on the road waiting for a bus, and it just was getting darker and darker and later into the night, and where is the bus? And I had no setting. And I continued to write. I wrote a second chapter, and I wrote that chapter from the voice of the young girl's mother, and I still didn't have a setting. And then I just cast my, intuitive web, you might say. I had never actually been to the South. The most South I had ever been was Washington, D.C., and Disneyland, which I don't think I've ever had the opportunity to put those two places in the same sentence before. But that's as far south as I'd gone. And something just called me to Georgia. I guess I have a sense of romance about the state of Georgia. Maybe it was Jimmy Carter was president when I was a little girl, and I remember him being an affable man. Maybe that stuck in my head, but I started to do research, reading history books and looking at Georgia websites. And what I read was about the mountains of southern Appalachia and the confluence of cultures in that area, Cherokee, who lived there first, the Scotch-Irish pioneers, and African-Americans who were brought there as slaves. And these three cultures intertwining, and each culture had their own ghost story. And I read that the terrain was filled with cataracts, waterfalls, and gorges, and I just felt I had to go there. So my husband and I got in the car, and we drove down the eastern seaboard. And when we got to the mountains of northeast Georgia, I knew I had found my setting. It was as lush and gorgeous as it had been described. And there were just these deep pockets of color, flowers I'd never seen before in my life, exotic orchids. It didn't look like what I imagined the South to be at all. It was just more like a rainforest. And I thought, this is a perfect place for my characters to inhabit, as well as my ghosts. I have ghosts in Glow as well as the living, who are sometimes not distinguishable, and I thought, shadow and light, playing in the forest, living in the forest, this was just perfect for Glow.
And so, did you then kind of plot out and map out your story from there?
No. No, I laugh because my background is in the theater as an actor, and improvisation to me is one of the biggest delights of the field. And I found that this works just as well in writing, at least for me. I sat down every day with my paper. I wrote the first draft by hand, and I allowed the words to come to me. And I don't mean I'm channeling or there was some divine force or anything of the sort. I just, as we are as people, we have thoughts all the time. We can never stop our thoughts. That's why people meditate. Even when we sleep, we're having, images come to us. So I allowed an image to come to me, and I stayed with the image. That was the discipline, was to stay with that one image rather than to allow another image or thought to intrude. And I wrote what that character saw, what that character was experiencing, what that character was doing, and that's how Glow grew. And that's how it grew into having five, but essentially four narrators. There's a fifth, but she only speaks for one chapter. They each have their own voice, and they came to me in their own way.
But then, well, of course, and again, I don't want to give anything away, but in the end, you kind of close the circle. So,
Yes. That came naturally. I mean, I really think if you listen to what your characters want to do, you can find a story. In fact, if I tried to make my characters do things that I thought would be exciting or, more interesting than what I was writing, I would get into a whole mess of trouble of actually not even liking my own writing.
right. Well, it almost, yeah, sort of, I get, I can understand that in thinking about the book, that there's this feeling of spirits in the book. And it maybe is that your characters were themselves telling the story to you.
That's how I like to think of it, but again, not to get
No, I
hocus
know.
pocus,
Right. No, I
I
understand.
mean,
But you're, I think writers experience, you're experiencing deep. Deep parts of the human mind. So it could be archetypal, it could just be
yes.
your own subconscious. Yeah, I mean, we
Oh,
don't have to.
absolutely. I think both play, and I think in any art form, artists are working from, yes, we work from the cerebral. We have to work. We're living human beings and in the intelligence. But for me, at least, art comes from a deeper place. Art is not, what I produce with my writing is not necessarily something I wish to produce consciously. The things that I'm exploring are things that are probably of subconscious interest to me. At least that's what I note in my writing as I'm writing another novel and I see similar themes coming up. At first, I thought when I was writing my first novel, I thought I was just repetitive. I didn't realize I was working something out for myself, for the characters, exploring your certain themes, that these things just arose naturally. And when another writer who was reading my first draft told me how amazing it was that I had explored these themes, and I thought, oh, okay, that's what I was doing. I was actually focusing on something. I wasn't beating a dead horse, so to speak.
Well, it, yeah, there's, I mean, there is a lot in the story about, I mean, what it relates to, it's about family connections and it's about, I mean, there's a lot of deep pain in this book, I have to say. Your characters have, many of them have suffered really just horribly, and terrible things have happened to them, and they've been able to, oh, many of the characters, not just your main characters, some of the side characters have had, just incredible suffering, particularly as you go back, you go back to the earlier 19th century, and you've got women who were slaves, men who were slaves. The suffering that they incurred is pretty powerful in the book, and that stuff, but the some of the racism continues, and the, some of the terrible things that happen to people who are, black or Native American in the book are very powerful, and it feels like there's you're working through a lot of pain there.
I think life is filled with everything, including pain. I've never met anyone who hasn't had a deep pain that they've had to overcome. And I mean, for me, one of the other sparks for the book was I grew up, my mother is Italian, Catholic. My father was Jewish, Romanian Jew. And when I was growing up, that was not a usual combination. And I went to Catholic school. And at the time, I had a Jewish last name. And I had to leave school to go with my dad to synagogue on High Holy Days. Even though I was raised Catholic and I went to church and I received all my sacraments, I lived in both worlds. And even though I lived in both worlds, I felt part of neither. When I was in the synagogue with my dad, I didn't speak Hebrew. I didn't know any other Jewish people. I felt like the Sheikh's daughter. And I remember going to Italy with my grandmother, and she introduced me as her Jewish granddaughter. So for me, it was a very complex, sometimes painful upbringing to belong in neither community, but to be part of both community. And the anti-Semitism that I experienced as a child, but I didn't know the word anti-Semitism. I didn't know why I was being bullied, or what have you. So, part of GLOW grows out of that. All of my characters, my main characters, are, I guess, what we would call mixed race. And, while people today may not see Italian as Jewish, as mixed race, it certainly felt that way when I was growing up in, the 70s. And in fact, when my parents got married, it was, I think it would, even though everyone grew to love each other, displeasing to both sides of the family. And one side of the family did actually not attend the wedding.
Right, and there is some of that in the book as well. I mean, I think
Yeah.
one of the things that struck me was that you portrayed in the early 19th century one of your, one of the key characters is a, the homesteader whose mother I think was Cherokee, and he, when this party of people come along, he ends up falling in love with this a black woman,
Yes,
and at a
who was
time.
enslaved.
Right, who was a slave at the time? At the time, it's that was pretty difficult, to say the least. I mean, in fact, up until, not that long ago, children of mixed race families in some most southern states were not counted as human beings.
No,
So.
and yet they existed and it happened with some regularity, sometimes against a woman's will, sometimes with her will. Native Americans and African Americans, be they freed or slave, there were relationships, the same with white people. And these relationships existed. They didn't just suddenly, pop up. And in some ways they were, when I say condoned, I mean they were accepted people in terms of people turned a blind eye. But certainly life was not easy for the children. Where do you fit in? You don't.
Right. No, that's true. And that I think all of the, so many of your characters are in that position. They're not
Absolutely.
really, they're partly in one place and partly in another. And all, and I also, I mean, of course, all of the chapters are the stories are told by women. So it's a, the women who are telling the story for the most part.
For the most part, there is one male narrator, who I. When I say I think of him as having strong feminine power, I don't mean to say that he is womanly, but he adored his mother, and I don't think he's had an opportunity to learn what macho is. So I think he's sort of just himself, whatever him not exactly raised by wolves, but definitely orphaned, and living in a secluded area. So Riddle, his name is Riddle, gets to develop as he would. He definitely has, manly desires, and he performs manly tasks of the household. But he also has to take care of his little sister and make her dinner, and if there's a rent in her clothing, he has to sew her clothing, and he has to take over the tasks of his mother
Right, and he's the
as
one who
well.
actually learns, in many ways, how to love among women.
Yes. He's both frightened and in awe of them.
Right. No, I thought that was, and actually, I think your ability to portray the men in that, who were, it was a difficult period of time, for men, to, it was, what you're describing was probably not, certainly common, but not, well, maybe common, but certainly not written about in history books, let's say.
And that's what interested me, what I hadn't read in the history books when I was in school, when I was in grammar school, and even when I was in high school. I just remember the teachers, I don't know if this is the curriculum or wasn't in the history books, just skirting around the war between the states, the Civil War. I definitely didn't learn about, at least I don't remember learning about the Trail of Tears. And that extended all the way through avoiding the Vietnam War. We didn't learn about that. It seemed anything that involved discrimination of that depth and horrors of that depth were avoided. It was fine to learn about the Monroe Doctrine, that kind of thing in the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. But things that pertain to American history that were not that long ago, even if it was only 150 years ago, at the time, seemed to be avoided or cleaned up. I do remember learning about Harriet Tubman. That was the only black woman I remember learning about, and everyone else was white. And of course, Cherokee or Choctaw were Indians, and they wore feathers, and that's about all I remember being taught about American history. And even the history was, forgive me, but seemed to be from the male perspective, what the men were doing in war, which is important. But what were the women doing? What were they at home? What were they doing? So I was interested in who's been left out of the story and what their story is.
Well, I think you succeeded there, and
Thank you.
certainly. Now, I want to talk a little bit about how you came to be a writer, because your writing is really good. I mean, it's you know,
Thank
I read a lot of books, and you know, there. I'm. This is not to say first novelists can't be really good, but you know, writers often spend years perfecting their craft to become really adept at writing, just the words and the ability to transform ideas into language. And I think you're really good at it.
Thank you.
The writing is very natural and you know, beautifully written, a beautifully written book. So I guess I'm curious to know about how you came to be a writer, since what I know of you is not about you're being a writer. You were, as you said, you've been an actress, but you've also studied anthropology and, you know, done a, well, I don't know what else you've done. So.
Filmmaking. My background is in filmmaking and theater. But, gee, how can I concisely explain this journey? Well, let's start with when I was 8 and I began reading the dictionary. I remember asking for a dictionary for my 8th birthday, and I received one, and I promptly began reading it. And to this day, I have a book of favorite words, and I write them down with their definition, their part of speech, sometimes the origin in a sentence using it. It was very important to my mom that I learn words, and I have no complaint because I am enamored with words. I come from a family. My mom gave me the passion for reading. We would go to the library when I was young, little, once a month, and we would take out the maximum allowed books per person, which was 15, and we would walk home with our canvas sacks filled with books. And to me, this was just such a delight. Going to that library and tilting your head to the right and seeing all those titles, it was just magical. I could pick out a book, and I would be invited into an adventure, and I would meet new people and a new land. Even if it was America, it was America at a different time, or America with people I'd never come into contact with myself. And I love the smell of library books, that sort of musty, dank smell, and this was heaven. And then I had the added bonus of my dad was a storyteller, meaning he just loved to tell stories. My dad could entertain anyone at any time with a story. So I grew up loving reading and enjoying storytelling, and I think it's no mystery that I became a writer. I think of myself more as a storyteller. I was in filmmaking for 13, at least 13 or 14 years. I still make films, and that's a form of storytelling. And then I became an actress, and I worked on one-woman shows, and that's another form of storytelling. So when I began my novel, I actually had thought it would be another play, and it seemed to have another form. And a friend of mine who is an author said, "Wow, this seems like it could be a novel." And I ignorantly said, "Sure, why not?" And so I began a novel, not knowing how to write one and needing to learn the craft and doing so, taking workshops and classes and learning. One learns to write by writing, reading and writing. I would read my favorite authors, underline their sentences, copy them into my journal, trying to understand the rhythm of a particular author. Toni Morrison is one of my favorite authors. I just adore his sentences. So many authors and so many journals filled with their words and working out my own words. My first draft was unwieldy, over 500 pages, filled with extra words, and that's a first draft. So I learned by doing.
So when you wrote the, I mean, just like you wrote, you said you wrote longhand. So you wrote the first draft, 500 pages of longhand. Did you then type it, or did you
Oh no,
edit?
that wound up being 500 pages of typed
Oh,
writing.
okay.
But somewhere along the line, I recall typing in what I had of my first draft. It may not have been a finished first draft, and then learning to create on the computer, which was another process for me, learning to create at a typewriter, essentially, a word processor. And once I, it's just a different animal. You're cutting and pasting and moving things around. You can do it so quickly. And sometimes you don't want that. When I write by hand, I can write 10 pages and cross out all of it and keep a sentence. And I don't know if I would do that if I was typing, because it's so easy just to delete a sentence if you don't like it right away. And you don't move things. I'm not cutting up pieces of paper and using tape to move things around. There was a natural progression to writing by hand, each word pushing the next one out. And sometimes, I mean, this may sound hokey, my youngest character used a pencil. It's sort of like in getting in character. Ella, who is the youngest main character, wrote in pencil and in print,
Right.
in
Well,
block
no,
letters.
it's you don't hear too many people who write by hand anymore, even
Oh, such a luxury, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but it seems, in some ways exhausting, I guess, compared,
No, no, think about it. Would you prefer if you were to receive a letter, one that was typed to you or one that was written for you?
I know, I understand that. I understand. No, I'm just thinking in terms of written the process of writing. Because I do a lot of writing, and I find that it's much more efficient to write on the computer.
See, I don't find it necessarily efficient. I just find it quicker, but not necessarily efficient, creatively speaking.
Well, no, and there's an argument. I can see the argument. There's one of my favorite writers is a geographer named Carl Sauer, and there's a line of his that goes back many years. It was about, and I can't remember it exactly, but it was about slowing down, and if you want to understand the landscape, you have to walk. You can't drive, you can't fly, you can't go fast. Can't even ride a bicycle through a landscape if you really want to see it. It can only be seen on foot.
I
And
like this. Yes.
yeah, and so I think there's a comparative there that I would say is probably true. It's just that we have to force ourselves because we're so busy and fast these days, to slow down. Which is the slow food movement, and there are probably other slow movements as well that try to get people
Slow
to,
writing.
yeah, right,
Maybe I'll start a slow writing movement.
exactly. Well, the slow writers probably have an advantage, because they don't have to worry about electricity being on. They don't have to,
It's true.
you can write
It's true. You can
outside.
write
That's
anywhere.
right.
And if you have a pencil, you carry a sharpener like I do.
It's true.
Or your favorite pens. I'm very fickle about my pens. Each
Do
one
you
has a
have
different
note
feeling.
particular notebooks that you like to use? Because a lot of
I do. I have a brand that I like, but it's not a
Well,
month
no
necessarily.
infomercials
No,
here.
no, no
No.
plugging my brand. But I do like paper that is unlined.
Ah,
I
interesting.
can say that.
Yeah.
Because I'll sketch, I'll draw, I'll write in any direction. I mean, part of being a writer, an artist with words, is finding, I think, a new way of putting them together that would surprise you, but yet still make sense. I mean, that's what poets do. I think I take great influence from poets and how they put words together in a way that I would never think to do. And you can do that, I think, more easily, for me at least, on paper. And what if I position a word at the top and I just suddenly feel like wanting to write one at the bottom? That's actually more efficient than scrolling down with my mouse.
Right. No,
It
that's
becomes
true.
such a conscious action to have to scroll down versus just a impulse. Or if, I want to put a dot and that's where this sentence is going to end on my paper. That's my challenge of the day. I'm going to draw dots on my, periods, essentially, on my blank paper, my blank sheet, and I must fill up by the end of the hour that page with the story, and the sentences have to end where that period is.
Right. Well, it's a good discipline, I think. Yeah. Well, do you draw a connection between your writing and your filmmaking? Are they similar in your in the process or in the imaginative way that you work, or do you feel them to be completely different?
Where they're the same is one of the things that drew me to filmmaking is lighting, the use of light. I think the films that make the biggest impression on me are ones that the light is used as a tool, very exquisitely, carefully. I don't know if you've seen Apocalypse Now.
Sure.
I've only seen it once, and I saw it a long time ago, and I remember this scene of Marlon Brando. He is in complete darkness, but we know there's somebody there. Maybe we hear an auditory cue, and suddenly he turns into the light, perhaps I think to speak to Martin Sheen's character, and we just see a portion of his face and how powerful that is, emerging from this murky blackness, and just a metaphor for the movie and the feeling of the movie and what this man psychologically might be going through. So I'm very attracted to light and paintings in movies, and chiaroscuro, the paintings of Rubens. And I do that. I tried to do that. I hope I achieved it in my writing, where maybe one scene you have a broken window at night, and there's a lamp light that is flooding through that window, and it's illuminating something very specific that I've chosen that light to illuminate, and only that, so that the reader's attention is on only that. Or, if someone has a gold tooth and looks up into the sun as he flips the coin and the sun reflects off of that gold tooth, well, that has meaning in that scene. I didn't randomly put in a flash of light on that tooth. So I feel there's a maybe an odd commonality between my filmmaking and my writing, is my attention to light and shadow.
No, I don't think that's odd. I think it's actually, a lot of writing is about sort of helping the imagination of the reader to visualize what the writer is trying to, what the writer imagines in that scene. So it makes sense to use visual cues, essentially.
Yeah.
And so maybe there is that. I mean, maybe that is the connection then. I was thinking, just because writing and filmmaking seem to be very different in some, maybe just, it's not just in the technical. But.
Yes, yes. I mean, with filmmaking, with a script, when writing a script, you have dialogue. That's essentially what you have. You have dialogue, and film is a very visual. Obviously, it's a visual medium. You can have a film and nobody speak. In fact, that's what I ask myself often. Does this film need to be visual? So the same thing with not the same thing, but with a book now, I have to create that visual for you. And how can I do that in a way that's interesting? If I tell you he's wearing a black hat, that's not so interesting. If I tell you, he removed his black hat and threw it into the coffin. What's that about?
Right. Well, it's visual action. And not, but I think that makes sense to me. The there you're really thinking about how do you show instead of tell?
Yes, yes. That's what we strive to do as writers, unless we wish to break the rule and there's a reason for telling.
That's right.
But with a film, another difference is we shoot out of sequence often, unless you have the luxury to shoot a film in sequence, and some do, and it would be my preferred way of working. But I wrote my book in sequence. I don't know how else to write it. It spans 100 years, from the Trail of Tears to the U.S. entry, into World War II, and five, as I said, five main characters. So I think I had to stay, even though it's the narrative is not linear, the story is.
Right.
So, I had to stay in sequence, at least in my head. And for me, my book is in sequence.
Well, yeah, no, it definitely is in sequence. It's just it's going backward in time to
Yes.
then come forward in time.
Yes, but what's being revealed is necessary in that moment.
Right. No, I thought it was
That's
great.
what I think.
Well, no, it worked for me. And
Good.
I mean, I think there were one or two places where I kind of had to think, well, I'm not quite sure where I am. I got to go back and, see who this person is in the, because a fairly complex set of characters who, they're related, but they're when you bring them up early, then they come back in another place, and sometimes you forget who belongs where. So, now of all the characters, who's your favorite? I kind of think
Oh,
I have mine. I'm wondering whether you have yours.
it's like asking a mother to pick between her children. Well, if I let's see. I mean, I do love them. I mean, maybe cliche to say, I do love them all, even my villains. But if I had to pick someone that I'd want in my life, I would want Willamette Cotton to be in my
That's
life.
right. She's to me the most powerful character in the book and the one who I wanted to know the most. And it's not that
Willamette is
any
special.
I would I'm not diminishing the power or the meaningfulness of anybody else, but she's you could do another whole book about her, I think. She's pretty amazing.
Thank you.
No, I
I
loved her.
enjoyed being with her.
Yeah, no, I wanted to know her more, so
Yeah.
I thought it was great. Well, I
Thank
really
you.
appreciate your taking the time to talk to me about your book. There's much more we could have talked about, but I'm glad we had the conversation that we did. And I just want to thank you for coming on my show.
Oh, my pleasure. And thank you for enjoying Glow.
Well, and good luck with this book and hopefully with your future books.
Thank you.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to Jessica Maria Tuccelli. She's the author of Glow, a novel, which I highly recommend.